Derek, I know in the last year that you've come out with a few books. Among them are Deep Green Resistance, Dreams, and I guess a collection of interviews, Truths Among Us. Maybe you'd like to talk about those, maybe starting with Deep Green Resistance.
Okay, sure. Deep Green Resistance began, maybe 5 years ago when me and my friends Eric McVeigh and Lear Keith were sitting around talking about why environmentalism is such a complete failure, really. I mean, in terms of actually stopping the destruction, because no matter what biological indicators you're talking about, they're all going the wrong direction. The same with social indicators. And the environmental movement keeps... I was just last night talking to a friend of mine, John Osborne, who really got me started in environmentalism 20-some years ago, and we were talking about, he said, I guess I just don't really learn because, I fought him at the end of the timber frontier here in the American Pacific Northwest, and now I'm fighting the end of the water frontier. They're running out of old growth trees, and now they're running out of water, and he says the same battle, and they use the same tactics, and their tactics always include, and he was just talking about this last night, that his wife filed a lawsuit, his wife's an attorney, and she filed a lawsuit having to do with this one dam, and they're actually, the Washington State legislature is actually passing a law to get rid of her lawsuit because the dam's violating laws. So, and this happens all the time. We were just sort of reminiscing about all the times we've seen this, where if you find a way to stop the destruction, those in power simply change the rules. If you find a way to use their rules to change destruction, they simply change the rules. And then there's, David Brower's famous quote about, all of our victories are temporary and our losses are permanent. And, I mean, the world's just being destroyed. And so many people will say in private that we need to just bring down the whole system, but people won't say it in public in general. And so anyway, Eric and Leah and I were talking about, let's think of what's a strategy that would really work. Because, once again, environmental strategies at this point basically are begging the capitalist-in-chief to not do what capitalists do and to not serve capital. And that's fine when they can throw you a bone here or there, but that's no way to actually stop this culture. I mean, one of the things I say in a lot of my talks is if space aliens had come down and they were systematically vacuuming the oceans and they were deforesting the planet and they were changing the climate and they were giving every mother, putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk, we would have a serious resistance movement. We would know what to do. But suddenly when it's capitalism, we get stupid. And so, the book is based on that strategy. It's a strategy. Okay, well, if we want a strategy that's actually going to work, what would it be? And the strategy, it's very clear what we need to do is to dismantle industrial infrastructure. And we need to destroy the capacity of the rich to steal from the poor and to destroy the capacity of the rich to destroy the planet. And so that's where that book came from, is that it outlines a strategy. If we actually do care more about having living oceans on the planet, the oceans are going to be dead in 20, 30 years. I mean, 90% of large fish are already gone. The oceans are acidifying. Shellfish along the Pacific Northwest coast in the United States can no longer reproduce because the oceans are too acidic already. Coral reefs could be gone soon, within 20, 30 years. And every time there's any sort of breach, I actually saw a study on this that I think it's every new prediction on how bad things are going to get with global warming or with species extinction, every new prediction, there's a 95% chance that it's worse than the ones before. You know, the politicians always like to pretend that the scientists are all doom and gloom, but the truth is that there are systematic attempts to, they don't want to lose credibility, so they understate how bad things are going to be 95% of the time, literally. They did a literature search on this. Anyway, if you want to live in a world that has living oceans, what are you going to do? Because one of the things we say in the book and then independently my friend John hasn't read the book yet, and last night he's saying the exact same thing, is that if there's anybody alive 100 years from now, they're going to wonder what's wrong with us, that we didn't fight like hell when the world was going down. And so that book is about that. It looks at historical resistance movements, what they did right, what they did wrong, how to organize. It's a very, very important book. So that's Deep Green Resistance. I'm the third writer on it. Eric McVeigh's primary and Lear Key's secondary. And then second book you mentioned was Truths Among Us. And what that is, I mean, it's a good book. It's a very good book. I used to do a lot of interviews, and I had several collections worth that I did that I wanted to get out into the public, and they were How Shall I Live My Life and Resistance Against Empire. This one, I've got another half dozen, and I'll probably do another half dozen to fill it out, and then we'll put that one out in a year or two. And it's a very good sort of overview of a lot of thought about you know, the problems with this culture, like all my work is. And then Dreams is a different direction, really. And Dreams, for years, I'd wanted to write a book about the relationship between dreaming and waking realities. And that book always got pushed aside because with the world being murdered, I don't have time to write about dreams. And then I realized that that's also a big part of the problem, in that, you know, I've said in so many of my books that the fundamental difference between indigenous and Western ways to be is that indigenous peoples all over the world perceive the world as consisting of other beings to enter into relationship with, as opposed to resources to be exploited. So they would perceive trees as having something to say, as they don't believe in that great chain of being, the sort of Christian hierarchy where you've got God, angels, man, woman, non-human, animals, plants. You know, they don't believe in that hierarchy at all. And they don't believe, you know, that one of the fundamental problems with this culture is the man, I'm using the sexist word intentionally, the man-nature dualism. And the reason I say man as opposed to human is because there's also the man-woman dualism. You know, and then men are above women, men are above rocks, men are above rivers. And years and years ago, I remember talking to Neil Everton. He was the first person who really helped me understand how ridiculous this is. And I said, well, where do you draw the line then as to who is, and really the line has to do with free will, it has to do with sentience. That's where we always put it. And I said, well, where do you draw the line then if you're not going to draw it? I mean, obviously dogs are sentient. Obviously cats are sentient. Obviously bears are sentient. So where do you draw the line? And he said, why do you draw a line at all? And that makes perfect sense. I mean, and this isn't just once again, this is so funny because I go back to science to validate it, even though indigenous peoples live, you know, the Talawa lived where I lived for 12,500 years, which is a really great way to know that their way of living had something that it was a better reflection of reality than the dominant culture, which has been here 180 years and the place is trashed. But anyway, there's some pretty interesting work being done by some scientists like Stephen Mancuso about plant intelligence. And it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, plants, I can't see how plants are any less intelligent than we are. So anyway, the point is that's one difference between Western and indigenous ways of being. But another difference is that I have never heard of an atheistic indigenous culture. And indigenous cultures have generally believed that dreams come from somewhere. Like I asked my friend Jeanette Armstrong, an Okanagan Indian, where do dreams come from? And she said, oh, everybody knows the animal to give them to us. And I asked Vine Deloria, the Indian writer, where do dreams come from? And he said that they come from the spirits. And that's way different than Western dream interpretation, which is that dreams are basically either meaningless or they're messages from your own unconscious. And there's a radical difference between having dreams be messages from someone else, that it is part of our job to help understand them so that we can live better, and messages from the unconscious. And so I wrote that book, and it's really about how it also is about how we can attempt to stop this culture from killing the planet. And that book is an attempt to, how do we find allies on other sides to fight against the dominant culture? Because we need all the help we can get. And then that led to the question pretty early on in the book. So if indigenous peoples have had allies on other sides, how is it that they've consistently been conquered? How is it that the dominant culture has continued to win? Is it because there actually are no allies? Richard Dawkins is right, and there is nothing in the universe. Is it because the Christians are right, and there is a God, and he's just this nasty piece of work who hates everybody? And one of the jokes I tell is that that God doesn't have a body, and God lives forever, if there is a Christian God, which I don't believe. But anyway, God lives forever, and he doesn't have a body, and several billion years is a long time to go without an orgasm. So that's why he hates bodies so much, is because he's really jealous that we get to have orgasms. Anyway, be that as it may, so maybe the Christians are right, and that's why they won, is because they've got this really nasty God on their side. Or maybe there's a whole bunch of gods, and I go through a whole bunch of possibilities for why the dominant culture could be winning. And the book, I saw a review of it that was pretty good, that was really good, actually, that I was very happy with it, that he talked about how it's really a book about epistemology. And epistemology is the question of how do we know something is real. And I want to say one more thing about that, and then I'll drop this, that Richard Dawkins, who's probably the foremost scientific philosopher at this point, I can't stand his work at all. I really hate it. It's very destructive. One of the things he says, and I analyze this extensively in the book, is science bases its claims to truth, a direct quote, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. And there's a sense in which that's true. You know, I flip on a switch and light comes on. And it's absolutely extraordinary how science has been able to control so much. It's an incredible means for harnessing power. But what he's done, which is incredibly sneaky, incredibly dishonest, and if we didn't have an entire culture of sociopaths, we would recognize this for the sociopathy that it is he has conflated the power to dominate with what is true. He said science bases its claims to truth. So how we know that science is true is its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. And once again, he's conflated being able to enslave others with truth. So, for example, if you and I were in the same room, I could put a gun on you, and I could say, okay, here's a hoop, I want you to jump through it now. And if you don't, I'm going to kill you. And what do you know? You jump through it. I must be a genius. But in doing so, in forcing you to jump through that hoop at the point of a gun, I have foreclosed other forms of knowledge. I've forever foreclosed other forms. You're probably not going to like me. You're probably not going to be my friend. I have foreclosed all forms of relationship knowledge by controlling you. And that's an extraordinary thing. That's the depth to which the sociopathology of this culture goes, in that it bases its very means of how we know that something is true, or how we believe something is true, really. How we believe something is true on our ability to control it. That's an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. And that's really what that book ends up being about.
And that actually leads into my first question about Endgame. But before I get into that, I just wanted to note is that effectiveness is the measure of truth. And you've already made this point that, you know, for many thousands of years, these cultures that are not civilized, so to speak, have been around living in harmony, living in a mutually beneficial relationship with the landscape or the land base, and here comes civilization for, what, a couple of centuries and manages to decimate everything around. So if effectiveness is the measure of truth, we can see that the Western mind, civilization, and the science and religion and the military prowess that back it all up is not nearly as effective as they claim to be. So it's a total fallacy.
It depends on what they mean by effective. If what you want to do is destroy the planet, it's a pretty darn effective way to do it.
Indeed.
If what you want to do is to live in place, if what you want to do is enslave everybody else, civilization's a great way to do it. It's very effective at that. If what you want to do is to be able to live in place long term, if what you want to do is survive, if what you want to have is long term interspecific cooperation, it's a terrible way. And these other ways are completely effective. You're absolutely right.
So, you know, and a lot of these statements undercut many of the main points that you drive at in Endgame. So getting to Endgame Volume 1, The Problem of Civilization, of course, you base the book on a set of 20 premises and a bunch of personal stories and historical information. I wanted to start with premise 11, actually. It states that from the beginning, this culture of civilization has been a culture of occupation. And I'd like you to talk about the culture of occupation and how it, in fact, does enslave everyone who lives inside of it, and compare and contrast that possibly with a culture of inhabitation and living in a loving and mutualistic relationship with the land base.
Well, what does the government of occupation do? And we'll talk about government first, and we can say the same thing about cultures. What does the government of occupation do? What's its function? What its function is it's supposed to move in, facilitate resource extraction, maximize production. That's what they do. You know, that's why the Germans invaded Russia, is because they wanted access to the Russian resources, land, oil, wheat land, people as resources for slaves. And this is what an empire does to colonies. It moves in, facilitates resource extraction, maximizes production. Likewise, what does the United States government do? What do any of these governments do internally even? What they do is they move in, they facilitate resource extraction, they maximize production. And, I mean, that's something that we have to understand, is that, I saw this great bumper sticker, U.S. out of North America. You know, the government is a government of occupation. It's not a government of inhabitation. A government of inhabitation would be, how do I live in place forever? How do I live here? Those would be the questions. How do I live in place without harming this land and, in fact, helping this land? A government of inhabitation would be all about, how do we organize ourselves such that we can live here forever? It's like Jeanette Armstrong also said to me, said, you know, we have just as many problems, you know, in, you know, squabbles as white people do, but the difference is that I know that I'm going to be living here for the next 500 years, or my family's going to be living here, and my great-grandchildren might have to marry your great-grandchildren, so that means we have to get along. It doesn't mean we don't fight. Or another way to put this is that the historian Ray Raphael is talking about, you know, one of the things that gets thrown out a lot that I just find so infuriating, Charles Mann does this, and it pisses me off too, they say that because Indians affected their land base, then that means that, as Charles Mann says, well, that means anything goes. And I've seen philosophers before, so it really makes me angry. They will basically say, well, since Indians affected their land base, that means it's okay for Boise Cascade to go in and deforest. And that's just obscene. And one of the differences, you know, I can make comparisons between, that's like saying that just because in loving heterosexual intercourse, you know, there may be, you know, the male and female genitals may be moving together, but just because that happens there, that rape is okay, because that's really sort of an apt analogy, because Boise Cascade deforesting is a toxic mimic of indigenous peoples living on their land. And we can talk about it on that level. We can also talk about, Ray Raphael just puts this very simply, which is, yes, of course, and he's writing about Indians in California. He says, the Indians, of course, were affected by land base. I mean, everybody affects their land base. I mean, bacteria affect their land base, salmon affect their land base, bears affect their land base. But the big difference is that the Indians were planning on living in place for the next 500 years. And that's a really profound statement. How does the fact that you're going to live in place for the next 500 years affect your land use decisions? Obviously, you're not going to put out pesticides. Obviously, you're not going to destroy aquifers. Obviously, you're not going to put in a mine. Obviously, you're not going to deforest. If you're planning on living here for 500 years, you're not going to destroy the topsoil. And it changes everything. So a culture of inhabitation would be asking those questions, would be planning on staying here, would be planning on inhabiting the place for the next 500 years. As opposed to a culture of occupation, or a government of occupation is going to use it up. It's going to be a government of drawdown. a culture of drawdown where it overshoots the carrying capacity, it destroys the land base, and moves on to the next one. And that's, I mentioned earlier, my friend John, who was talking about the end of the timber frontier, that, and the end of the water frontier, that what do you do when you get to the end of this? Well, they keep exploiting, they keep exploiting, they're going to keep exploiting until there's nothing left but ashes and dust unless we stop them, which takes us back to PGR.
Derek, in premise 10, you state that this culture as a whole and most of its members are insane and that we're driven by a death urge. And this is an inculcation. It's done by intelligent design, it appears to me, and you make that case in your book, that the government actually indoctrinates us into a mythology that is so destructive, but we're somehow led to believe that this insanity is normal and sane.
One of the favorite lines that I ever wrote was in Culture of Make-Believe, and that book was supposed to be a book about, it was supposed to be a 5-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups. And I made the mistake of asking what's a hate group, and I ran into problems right away because I looked up a KKK website to see what they say about themselves. How do you define a hate group? And the KKK website said, we're not a hate group, we're a love group. And the reason they said they're a love group is because they love whites. I was like, okay, so either A, we can't, you know, either A, the KKK is not a hate group, or B, we can't trust rhetoric. Well, that opens up a whole huge can of worms, because if you can't trust rhetoric, what do you trust? Because if you go just by the numbers, then the largest segregationist, racist organization in the world is the U.S. judicial and penal system, because it's achieved segregation of African-American males on a scale that the KKK can only dream of. You know, about 33% of African-American males from the ages of 18 and 35 are under so-called criminal justice supervision. And in some cities like Baltimore, it's over 50%. And once again, that's the KKK wet dream. So how do you tell what hatred is then? And so I started doing this whole examination, which ended up being like 700 pages, and probably one of my favorite lines in the book is where I say that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like economics or religion or science or just the way things are. And what I mean by that is that I want to bring in one more piece of the puzzle, which is Robert J. Lifton, probably the world's foremost authority in the psychology of genocide, talked extensively about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you're doing, and others, that what you're doing is not in fact an atrocity, but instead you're actually doing something good. And so he would, for example, the Nazis weren't committing genocide. They were purifying the Aryan race. They were actually doing a good thing from their own perspective. And likewise, oil and gas people or timber people or whatever are not destroying the world. They're not murdering the planet. They are developing natural resources. And when you have an entire culture that has these social rewards set up for, I mean, like all those fundamentalist Christians who are really homophobic or misogynist, they're, you know, when we think about hatred, we think, you know, the first thing that comes to mind when I think of hate is sort of, you know, red faces and shouting and that's actually not hatred. That's more fury or rage or something. But hate can be manifested through, I mean, you know, Hitler never killed any Jews, and Himmler, in fact, fainted when he saw Jews getting killed face to face. It was all bureaucratic, and so hatred can be, you know, think about this with slavery, you know, with the slave trade, that it could be, it was economic. This hate-based economy was. There were a bunch of people making a lot of money. They did it for that reason. They didn't overtly necessarily hate those they were enslaving, although they actually had to, of course, because you can't do those atrocities unless you actually do hate them. And then, or look at pornography. You know, oh, just people, men are just getting off. But the truth is that that's all based on objectifying and demeaning women. And the reason I bring up pornography, well, for a couple reasons. One is because it's massive, massive. I just read the other day that that pornography is a larger economy than sports and Hollywood combined.
Amazing.
And this is an entire economy that's based on demeaning women. But there's another part of this too, which is that Eve Ensler asked me to write, she wrote the Vagina Monologue. She asked me to write something for, she's got a new thing coming out in the next year or two. The working title is The Man Box, which is where it's talking about men within patriarchy. And one of the things I talk about is that one of the reasons that patriarchy is so harmful is that within patriarchy, and this is not a biological thing, this is a cultural thing, that within patriarchy, the way you validate yourself as a man is by defining, it takes us back to the beginning too with the whole man-woman, man-nature dichotomy or dualism, that the way you define yourself as a man is by defining some other as other and inferior. And it can be women, it can be members of other races, it can be children, it can be non-humans, it can be the planet itself, it can be a river, it can be indigenous peoples. So you define this other as inferior, and then you violate them. And in your violation of them, that validates your superiority and validates your masculinity. And also, in so doing, I mean, one of the unfortunate things for the planet is that there are always, this is entirely insatiable for a couple reasons. One is that actually violating someone else doesn't actually validate anything. So as Artie Lang said, you're trying to plug a void using a void, and that doesn't work. And the other problem with this is that there's always someone new to violate. And so you are never in this masculine position. You are never secure in your masculinity. You have to keep violating again and again and again. That's why they bombed the moon. I mean, at this point, I mean, they violated the forest, they violated the prairies, they violated the rivers, they violated women. Good God, there's like 900 million women right now alive, who have been raped in their lifetime. And that's not front page news. That's not something that is discussed. They bomb the moon. They send probes to the deepest folds of the ocean. They're violating DNA. I heard this great line by, what's his name? I can't remember his name. He's the guy who first encoded or figured out the human genome. And he's got a patent out now for the first life, and he's first artificially created life. It's really, really evil. And one of the things that he said is he's talking about how he wants to make this algae do something or another. And actually, I'm gonna look for this real fast because it's such a perfect line to encapsulate everything we're talking about. James Venter, I think his name was, Craig Venter, and he has this line: "The genetic tools give us a new approach to being able to rewrite the genetic code and get cells to do what we want them to do. To get cells to do what we want them to do." That takes us right back to Richard Dawkins, and so that's this hate. Is like, he wouldn't say, "No, I hate cells." He wouldn't say that at all. But the truth is, you have to hate cells in order to enslave them. You can't hate life you can't enslave life without hating it. And so how we get enculturated into this is this is what we breathe every day. This is, I mean, on the smallest little level, you know, I type into the computer, the trees who do this, the stones who do this, and it tells me it's wrong. It tells me the grammar is incorrect, that it should be the trees that, because a tree isn't a who. Mm-hmm. But that's the level of objectification that this culture has. It's in the grammar. It's everywhere in this culture. So this is what we are raised in, is we are raised to believe that non-humans have nothing to say. We're raised to believe that. I mean, how are we taught homophobia? You know, I used to routinely use the word fag when I was growing. Not when I was a kid, because I didn't use any pejoratives when I was a kid. I was raised a fundamentalist Christian where one did not. I didn't even say, you know, damn. I didn't swear it off. I never would have used a pejorative, but there was still homophobia in the family. Don't get me wrong. But then when I got into high school, you know, everybody, it's like the common slang was to call somebody a fag, and it didn't mean anything to me. And I figured out what was going on with that. It took me a while to do this, even after I'd learned this, but I had a friend who was bisexual, and I was teaching him how to drive, and he ran my car into a pole, and I said, "Oh, you fag." And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, I'm a fag. What's that to do with me running your car into a pole?" And I suddenly understood that this wasn't just a series, this just wasn't three letters, that this was actually a pejorative, this was actually hate speech. And my point is that that's how we get inculcated, is just by hearing it all the time and by it being just everyday commerce. It's language, it's everyday conversation. That's how we learn this hatred. You know, I say, you know, I was walking through the forest and the tree told me, I was having trouble with what I should write next and the tree told me. And there are some people who've written to say, "Thank you so much, that's my experience too." And there's other people who've written me to say, "God, you're a nut job." And I mean, I don't know of many other white people who will say explicitly, "The stream told me to say this." And that's how this bigotry is perpetuated.
You make the claim in your book that this inculcation is not the unintended consequences of a bunch of systems that are, say, competing for power or trying to establish stability. In fact, rather, what's taking place is a very calculated attempt, and you use the phrase full spectrum dominance to refer to, I guess it was the probably the 2002 defense guidance plan or whatever it was. But, you know, I think in terms of full spectrum dominance regarding the whole of our culture and civilization, the military aspects, the environmental aspects, the control and the hatred that you say in one of your premises over our body, the disrespect for nature, the hatred of nature, that this is all part of this full spectrum dominance. In fact, I was speaking with one of the co-founders of the Freedom Theater of Jenin, Palestine, and I asked him about occupation, and he said, you know, the occupation is much more than a physical military occupation. It's the occupation of identity. And maybe I can get you to comment on that occupation of identity as part of the full spectrum dominance.
Well, we see that, excuse me, we see that everywhere too, that one of the jokes I like to tell is that a friend of mine would call me up and say, "So how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq?" Well, I guess I have to say Afghanistan now. "How much longer do you think we're going to be in Afghanistan?" And I'd look around and I'd say, "I didn't know we're in Afghanistan. I thought we were in Northern California." And my friend would say, "So how much longer do you think our troops will be in Afghanistan?" And it's like, "I got troops?" And the point is, or like, I talk to my mom. My mom gets so annoyed at me when I do this. I talk to my mom. My mom says, "It's just terrible that we torture." I'm like, "Oh my God, Mom, you torture? That's terrible. Who do you torture?" And she's like, "You know, I'm your mother. Don't do this to me." And the point is that we identify with the culture itself. We identify with the government in that sense. They're not my troops. The United States invaded Iraq. The United States invaded Afghanistan. I didn't invade. I didn't torture. And one of the first things we can do is we need to separate ourselves. I got a note the other day from a woman who had been sexually assaulted. And it was because I've got a book coming out this fall that I wrote with Stephanie McMillan called The Knitting Circle Rapes Annihilation Squad. It's a novel, and it's a darkly comic novel of these women who are in a knitting circle, and they all realize that they've been sexually assaulted and nothing happened to the rapist. So they start killing rapists with knitting needles. And then it becomes this huge movement where women all over the planet and their male allies are killing rapists in all sorts of creative ways. And I announced this to my email list, and this woman wrote to me to say, "Please don't publish this book." I have forgiven my rapists, and, you know, you need to model this sort of behavior too. And I didn't write back to her, but I was thinking, you know, just basically how sad this is that she so identifies with the perpetrators that she doesn't even want for fictional rapists to have any sort of accountability. And then there was another line in her note that said, "We are all raping the planet." And it's like, no, actually, we're not. There are perpetrators. And one of the big cons that's happened over the last 20 years, especially 30 years, has been in the 1980s was the first time that corporate newspapers called people consumers rather than calling them citizens or human beings. And if they can get us to identify as consumers of their system, then they've really won. Because, well, I need to back up a little bit and say a couple of directions. But one of them is that so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what they've meant by that is we need to recognize that civilization is not good. We need to recognize that it's killing the planet. We need to recognize that the government doesn't have our best interests at heart. It's like Thomas Lindsay does fabulous work. He's an activist, and he does a lot of work, like when various townships in Pennsylvania want to write in ordinances saying that there can't be any gigantic hog farms there, corporate hog farms, or there can't be any fracking there. He helps them do it. And one of the questions I asked him is, you know, the United States Constitution has this Commerce Clause that says that it withholds the ability to regulate commerce rests not with the community but with the state and federal governments. And so if all of your ordinances can get overturned at the state and federal level, why are you wasting your time? And he said, because when the people come to me, they still believe that we live in a democracy, and they believe that a community should be allowed to say whether their rivers are polluted by a corporate hog farm or by fracking. And they still believe that. And so I say, great, I will help you. And then I help them with the ordinance, and the ordinance just is very simple. We want control over our local economy. We want control over what happens to the land here. Very straightforward and important stuff. And then it gets squashed by the feds. And suddenly these people who before then believed we lived in a democracy now understand we don't live in a democracy. And that's a great way to build revolutionary cadres. And it's just, John Osborne was saying the same thing last night. He said he's been working with these farmers who are getting their aquifers being destroyed by a huge factory feedlot for cattle. And he said, you know, these people, these farmers, until this thing started, they still believe we live in a democracy. And I didn't mention Thomas Lindsay to him. He knows Thomas Lindsay, but that was his language. So many people are seeing this where until they run up against it, they believe we live in a democracy. And that's one of the things we need to recognize. We don't. I mean, one of the questions, I appeared at a bunch of Occupies, and I said at each place, do you believe that the government takes better care of corporations or human beings? And, you know, I ask this question all over the country, and nobody ever says it takes better care of human beings. We all know we don't live in a democracy, but that's one of the first things we have to do to decolonize, is to recognize we don't. Because your forms of resistance are different if we don't live in a democracy than if we do. You know, in World War II, if I lived in Denmark, I would have one form of resistance. World War II, occupied Denmark, I would have one form of resistance. If I live in occupied Poland, it's a different form of resistance. So we need to look at the situation we have before we can do anything about it. So that's part of the decolonizing. Part of it is to separate ourselves from them, to recognize that I am not the head of Weyerhaeuser. The head of Weyerhaeuser is deforesting, and my culpability for deforestation comes not because I use toilet paper, but instead because I don't stop Weyerhaeuser. We need to stop them. So we need to separate ourselves from them, so we're not fighting ourselves when we fight them. That's part of what we need to do. Oh, you know, there's a great line I never forget by Harriet Tubman, except of course I'm not butchering, but basically it's, I freed hundreds of slaves, and I could have freed hundreds more if they would have only known they were slaves.
Yeah, exactly.
And another way to put this is that, Jack Forbes wrote this great, this isn't a fictional story, this great story, and in there he had these lines about how before you can really liberate yourself from being a slave, you have to fully understand your condition, which means you have to feel the terror and degradation of being a slave. First thing, I mean, that's why we don't want to feel this, is because we don't want to, well, one of the reasons we don't want to, one reason we don't want to recognize we're slaves is because we don't want to recognize our powerlessness. And we have to recognize our powerlessness before we can find out where our power is. And we have to recognize we're powerless in that system, and then it's like, oh, okay, well, we'll move over to this other way of thinking where we've got some power. Another reason, honestly, that we don't fight back, another reason that we in the United States, many of us, not all of us, but many of us in the United States, is because we have privilege. You know, I get so tired of, I mean, it's so interesting. I used to do, or still, when I talk about fighting back, the response by an audience is really predictable, which is a lot of mainstream environmentalists, a lot of, especially the sort of, what I derisively call the environmental intelligentsia, say, oh, no, we can't fight back. They put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield. And other groups of people have entirely different responses. A lot of people of color, a lot of poor people, a lot of survivors of domestic violence, a lot of family farmers, American Indians. You know, when I talk about physically fighting back, they're like, yeah, let's go, bro. Tell me something we don't know. And the difference between those groups is that the latter groups have experienced much more violence directly. They don't have that privilege of ignoring violence. It's a part of life and you deal with it. Doesn't mean you participate, doesn't mean you don't, but you deal with it. And for the former groups, there's a great line by Upton Sinclair. It's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And I would expand that to say it's hard to make someone understand something when their privilege depends on them not understanding it. And you know, the world's being killed, and we need to decolonize. We need to decolonize fast.
In premise 6, you state that civilization is not redeemable and this culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. And you mentioned maybe at best we can soften the blow, but we're in for a hard landing, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, this years ago I did a talk at Bioneers, and it broke my heart. And the reason it broke my heart is because I was the only person there who was talking about either power or sociopathology. And I don't understand how you can talk about social change without talking about power. I don't understand how you can talk about the murder of the planet without talking about sociopathology. And if we won't even talk about the reality, what are we going to do about it? I mean, you get all these emails all the time, oh, the shift is hitting the fan. It's like, oh, please. You know, it's everything's going the wrong direction. It's just, they've even done studies. This is really, really pretty horrifying, but it makes perfect sense. There's studies have shown that, you know, sort of if you quantify people's compassion by asking questions, would you have empathy with the person in this case? In the last 20 years, college students' sort of quantified empathy has gone down by like 50%. It's really horrifying. And it makes perfect sense with the increased technologization of the world, with the increased you know, the ubiquity of pornography, just the sort of madness that comes at the end of empire. Yeah, I don't see, I mean, for crying out loud, there was a poll the other day of Americans on global warming, and 49% of the United States public doesn't believe it's happening. This is, you know, and, okay, here where I live, the amphibian population, the amphibian population is collapsing everywhere, and and here's another thing about global warming. I just noticed the other day, only 32 minutes, the main news station spent a total of 32 minutes, discussing global warming in the past year. 32 minutes. How long did they spend discussing Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, you know, or, you know, I don't know, how much time have they spent? I just did an essay for Orion. You know, I've said for years we don't live in democracy. I just did an essay for Ryan, it's going to be out, I think, in May or June, that talks about how there's a sense in which we do live in a democracy. And one of the things one of the ways I talk about this is that there's a recent college championship football game between the Louisiana State University Tigers and Alabama. And 70-some thousand people went to the stadium. The median ticket price was $1,500. And they closed schools in the area and out of excitement about the game. And 14 million people watched it on television. And my point is that there are more people who care about the Louisiana State University's Tigers football game, football team, than care about real Tigers. You know, it's like the county where I live in far Northern California, and when people think of Northern California, the first agricultural product they think of is marijuana. And the county where I live, in California, medical marijuana is legal. In the county where I live, the board of supervisors was going to drop the number of plants you can have from some number to another number. And the board of supervisors meeting was packed that night. And this is how participatory democracy is supposed to work, is if the representatives try to do something you don't like, then you stop them. And the place was packed, and they wouldn't allow them to change the rules. Well, they did change rules, but not as much as they wanted to. And the point is that it breaks my heart that people in this community care more about marijuana. I mean, I think medical marijuana is fine. That's not the point. But it breaks my heart that more people care about that than they care about salmon. You know, whenever there's something up having to do with salmon or plovers or anything wild, I mean, the only three ways you can get people in this county to show up at the Board of Supervisors meeting, two ways really, are either A, for marijuana, or B, for off-road vehicle use, in favor of it. And that's what they care about. And people in this culture care more about the Super Bowl than they do about the future existence of wild oysters, or the future existence of salmon, or the future existence of hummingbirds. Oh, I started to say about the amphibian die-off that 5 or 6 years ago, it was so loud in the forest here at night that you couldn't have a human conversation because of the frogs singing. And the amphibian die-off's coming home, and now there aren't very many. And I was talking to someone else who lives in the same forest that I do, and he hadn't even heard that the frogs weren't singing. He hadn't noticed. And I guarantee that this person, if I called him right now, he would be able to tell me that the San Francisco 49ers lost last night, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's where the priorities are. And, I mean, I'm horrified. And I don't think, I mean, the bitter truth is that people in this culture care more about, it's like after Fukushima. I wrote a column on this for Orion a while back. After Fukushima, one of the ministers in Japan, Minister of Energy or something, said that they're going to continue with nuclear because, quote, we cannot imagine living without electricity, end quote. Never mind the fact that humans existed very, very well without electricity for almost all of our existence. And never mind the fact that most humans still living are almost most humans, like half of all humans living right now, don't have access to electricity. Never mind all that. But can you imagine a government leader saying, we cannot imagine living without polar bears. We cannot imagine living without cod. We cannot imagine living without amphibians. Cannot imagine living without bats. They won't say that. What they say is, we cannot imagine living without the ways that we have further enslaved the planet. What it is, it's an addiction. There's not going to be a transformation because there's an addiction. And I can easily see a junkie saying, I can't imagine living without heroin. And one of the problems is that, you know, it's a cliche that addicts don't change until they hit bottom. But one of the problems is that when someone is addicted to enslaving others, when someone is addicted to abusing others, it's like Lundy Bancroft wrote this great book about abuse. And one of the points he makes in there is that abusers so rarely change because they're receiving tangible benefits, and it's not them who hits bottom. It's everybody else who hits bottom. They're doing fine, thank you very much. And people in the United States are doing fine, thank you very much, compared to the salmon. I mean, obviously there's the economic crisis going on, but the point is that the Occupy, this is one of the things I said at the Occupy movement, you know, asking for a bigger piece of the pie as the world is murdered is a wee bit insufficient. And the point is, it's salmon who are hitting bottom, and it's Delta smelt who are hitting bottom. It's bats who are hitting bottom. It's not entitled members of this culture. It's indigenous peoples who are hitting bottom. And So that's one reason this culture isn't going to change, is because the social reward system is there to reward their enslavement of others.
Derek, one of the things that blows my mind is that, and again, the people who are, so to speak, running the show, they've got to be aware that we're living in a world of finite resources, yet everyone seems to be functioning with this strange magical thinking that there's an infinite amount of resources that we can utilize. And if you do take a look, for example, at amphibians, an indicator species of the health of an environment, you realize quickly that the complex web of life is being demolished, and that in let's say in their language, we're at the top of that evolutionary chain, which I don't personally believe. But the point, of course, being is that in drawing from a virtual infinite set of resources from a finite well, we're ultimately destroying ourselves, and that somehow we don't, you know, incorporate that into the language we use and the actions we take. And, you know, forgetting about the government and what their end game is, you know, we have to educate ourselves. We have to somehow separate ourselves from this mythological thinking so that we can learn to break free of this insanity and break free of actually what I would consider is that we're indoctrinated to kill ourselves. So how do we embrace that notion, and how do we get out of that?
I think that it's like a doctor friend of mine says, that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And I think, I mean, it's like the Harriet Tubman line, the first thing we have to do is to recognize our condition. And then the solutions become much more technical. It doesn't mean daunting, but we need to not accept. I mean, whoever asks the questions gets to frame the answers. And so, for example, we hear all the time, you know, how do we stop global warming? And when people say, how do we stop global warming, normally they're not asking how do we stop global warming, because it's pretty obvious how you stop global warming, which is you destroy the oil infrastructure. Bingo. Done. Instead, what they're asking is, how do we stop global warming without dismantling the oil infrastructure, without dismantling this way of life? The answer is you can't do it. Same when they talk about saving salmon. How do we save salmon? What they're really asking is, how do we save salmon without taking out dams, without stopping the logging, industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without stopping industrial agriculture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? You can't. That's the magical thinking. It's like, how do you... So, once again, the point is that we need to look at our circumstances clearly, and we need to then, and then after that, the answers become much more straightforward and technical. But the first thing we have to do is to have conversations like this that help us to recognize the circumstances, to help us to analyze them, and then we move forward from there. And we recognize that there are a lot of people who are simply not reachable. And by that, I'm not just meaning people like, you know, the capitalist in chief. I'm not just meaning those in power who are definitely not reachable. One of the problems I have with sort of the deep ecological movement, and, you know, it's great. You know, they recognize the problem's really deep, but then their solutions are always, well, we wait for a cultural transformation. I was like, well, why don't you just wait for Santa Claus to bring you a new culture for Christmas, you know? It ain't going to happen. It's like, I gave up on Santa Claus when I was a child. And we need to recognize what Frederick Douglass said, power can seize nothing without demand. We need to look at that history too. And then we need to stop those who are perpetrating the atrocities. We need to destroy their capacity to perpetrate the atrocities.
You said that your book was originally intended to be a sort of evaluation of when is it appropriate to use violence. And one of your premises is that, you know, love does not imply pacifism. And you bring that point out a lot in your book, that you're dealing with the people with the Gandhi shield and a lot of fence sitters. And in reality, you know, just because we're loving, you know, doesn't mean we can't use violence. And I guess you also take a look at that in your new book, Deep Green Resistance, where you're looking at other forms of resistance to, you know, the occupation of mind and the planet. So if you have any comments on that.
Well, that's another level at which we have been taught to identify with the oppressor, because they care more about, I mean, so often that compassion ends up being compassion for the perpetrators. Like that person who just wrote to me to say she had forgiven her rapist, and that's fine. I'm glad you forgave your rapist, but you actually don't get to forgive them for the other women that they've raped, and you don't get to forgive them for, and in fact, let's pretend that the person who raped you raped someone else afterwards. You not stopping him, I'm not saying that person's responsible for the next one at all. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that stopping rape, and one of the things she says in the note to me was, no, you need to be an example of the world that you want to live in. And it's like, actually I am. I don't want to live in a world with a bunch of forgiven rapists. I want to live in a world where men don't rape. And the way we stop them is by stopping them. I don't want to live in a world of forgiven capitalists. I want to live in a world without capitalists. I want to live in a world without capitalism. So I think that this sort of, I keep thinking about, one time someone asked Chekhov, he said, I want to write a story, but I don't know what to write about. And Chekhov said, write a story about someone who squeezes out every drop of slave's blood in them. And I think that that's what we need to do, is we need to ourselves squeeze out every drop of slave's blood, which certainly includes sort of a smug belief that this is one of the things that kills me about so much of the pacifism, is that there's this insane belief that somehow having compassion for perpetrators or forgiving perpetrators is better than stopping them, and or that forgiving or having compassion for perpetrators actually does stop them. And that's completely insane. And that's a level, and once again, that's fine that you have compassion for people ask me a lot of times, do you have compassion for the perpetrators of sexual assault, the perpetrators of capitalism? And it's like, no, my compassion is with the victims. And if I have any left over, sure. And besides which, people ask me this, you know, my father was abusive. And people have said, do you forgive your father? And they say, well, I can't forgive someone who hasn't changed. And that's the thing, is once capitalism's over, then we can talk about, see, this is the thing that pisses me off, is they're talking about this forgiveness when it's still ongoing. And they're talking about this compassion when it's still ongoing. Once it's all done, then we can talk about truth and reconciliation. But so long as the atrocities are continuing, I have no interest in truth and reconciliation. What I have an interest in is stopping the atrocities. And it boggles my mind that somehow someone can attempt to take the moral high ground when they are not stopping atrocities.
Talking about when the victim views the perpetrator with this compassion, they're actually becoming subject to, you know, I guess what is very common psychologically is that we identify with the abuser and somehow put the blame on ourselves. So it seems like a deep psychological phenomenon, not only in personal relationships, but even at the societal and cultural level of civilization.
Oh, yeah, completely, completely. I mean, we have an entire culture that has Stockholm Syndrome, you know? And we see why, because that's where the power is. And it's much, I mean, picture yourself being in some abusive situation, some, like a prison, and it's much easier, you know, if you get rewards for sucking up to the guards and you get beaten for not, you know, a lot of people are going to suck up to the guards. And we have an entire culture that's based on those reward systems. People are systematically rewarded for accumulation. People are systematically rewarded for defending that privilege. And you're systematically not rewarded for doing otherwise. So it takes a lot of decolonization in order to get to the point of resisting.
Derek, I know you have to get going, and I really appreciate your time. As someone who's recently gotten involved in some shamanistic studies and the world of dreams, I'm very interested in visiting that book with you, as well as Endgame Part 2, The Problem of Civilization and Deep Green Resistance, because, of course, I would imagine therein lies some of the solutions to the huge global problems that we're facing today. So, again, thank you for your time, and I hope we'll have an opportunity to speak again.
Oh, yeah, it'd be fun. It's a great interview. Thanks
so much. Soon. Definitely.